Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you back to my home. I appreciate you being here. It means a lot that you showed up. This whole process for making this has been crazy, weird, different. Like, I've been doing this for almost 3 years now, and I guess it's gotten so normal, and I've gotten sort of into a habit with it. And I know I've been saying for a long time that I'm going to start adding some new segments and shit, but I'm just technologically not equipped at the moment. Maybe I can find some help eventually, or I can afford some help. But I'm very comfortable now being able to sit here and talk to you. And that took me a while. You know, and that comfort comes with a sense of, like, work. Like, you know how, like, work is tedious sometimes, you know? Like, and I always kind of, like, have to talk myself up into being willing to speak. And I enjoy doing it. I love doing it. And that's my point in mentioning it is, like, because as soon as I sit in front of the microphone and as soon as I'm in the action, it's never as bad as I thought it was going to be, you know? And this could be applied to a lot of other different situations, you know? Like, I used to feel similarly about going to the gym, you know? There's a lot of times that the anticipation and the hesitation when we start to approach things makes it so much more difficult than the actual event itself, which is what I was talking about last week with my approach towards work and my ambivalence towards not wanting to do it, which is human, you know. But we need to always consider all of that extra energy applied to situations that are not here and now, right here and now. What's going on right now? I'm gonna say it over and over again. Look around you. You know, I can describe to you what's in front of me, but then you'll start building a picture inside your head, and that's not what's in front of you. So your mental image right now, I want to be your outside image. Look around you and then see where you're at. Like, are you at work right now? Are you driving? Are you doing household chores? Like, whatever we're doing is not thinking about what's going on tomorrow. Like, it's crazy. And now I'm in, like, I'm looking forward to this upcoming week, but I'm trying not to do that because I worked really, really hard this week again. And after complaining about it last Sunday when I was speaking with you, I get a call Sunday afternoon, and I finished my project right around like 2 or 3 o'clock on Sunday. So I was pretty busy Saturday and Sunday. And so I only had a couple hours of rest last week. Well, I had every evening, but I only had a couple hours of, you know, classically defined quote rest unquote. Like, and so I'm sitting there and I'm trying to get the best out of it. And all of a sudden I get a text message and my boss goes, I'm really sick right now. Would you mind to do the cleaning tomorrow night? Which would be a 9-hour day at the kitchen and then a 5-hour day cleaning. And immediately without any hesitation, I just messaged the man and I said, of course, I got you because I care and empathy stepped in. And when I could do something for a person, I can do it easily. And over the next half hour, it started to fall in on me all the things now that I was going to have to do tomorrow. And I started to feel that ambivalence again. And it sucks because you want to help people, but sometimes you don't want to do it. I think that's normal. And like, so I just ended up working super hard. And then to make matters even worse, my project, my extraction turned out to go bunk and did not yield any results. And so in some layer of description that I could apply to the situation in my head, you know, I just wasted my whole time and I got no rest for it. But the point in bringing up all this stuff is I want to allocate a dimension to that kind of thinking. And I would hazard to guess that that kind of thinking is going to be in all of our lives, just wearing different kinds of masks and approaching in a different way, because we all have our different scenery and setting. Because that's the mind fuck of it all. Like, everything is intrinsically connected. Everything is bound and interdependent. Reality and existence as it is in Tathagata and suchness, this is a totality, a unity. You know, the universe is in some conceptual reality, which is, that's the mindfuck of it, because this is still thinking. Like, this is still being meshed through the intellect just to get to this point. And that's what allows me to speak to you about it. That's what makes it jhana. Like, so that's what makes even a lot of these statements empty, which is why if you're not used to a lot of these ideas, I think you immediately glimpse it as empty. But there's still immense meaning in it, which is the mindfuck. So everything is this unit, but at the same time, we are all unique. Like, the concept of Maya, which comes from Hinduism, and you can also read about in Buddhism, Maya has often been translated as illusion. But it's not a fake illusion, it's a very real one, you know? Like, you know, in the movies where somebody's dreaming and they're like, well, if I die in the dream, I just wake up, and then the other person, because they're like hooked in through some weird machinery, I don't know, but the other person's like, no, if you die in the dream, you'll die in real life too. You know, that's because it's like, it's not real. It's not the real world, quote unquote. But it's very real, and it has big, quote, real world, quote unquote, like fucking ramifications and effects on how you perceive everything. So it's like, you can't discredit these concepts, you know? Like, and one breed of these concepts would be like future thinking or past thinking, you know, using the imaginarium to guess what's going to happen tomorrow. If you're waiting on something, you know, trying to hypothesize and guess what the outcome is for that something, right? So using this paradox of everything being connected, but I'm also me, you know, and applying that to compassion and sympathy for ourselves. And I was listening to this man earlier this week on a video call. He's this really cool guy named Shane. He speaks a lot about IFS sort of stuff, which IFS is internal family systems. So therapeutic models. He's very, very motivated to try to help people. And when I was having a difficult time a couple weeks back, I even sat on the phone with him and spoke to him for a while. But he's always pushing this idea of self-compassion and self-love. And he will look at that through this generational lens, or this, like, looking at our past and seeing where we've had traumas or stressors, or we've mishandled or handled greatly all these situations in our lives, and how this has an effect on how we know how to love ourselves. So if we grew up in a family where the family doesn't know how to express compassion, which is super common in a society like the United States that I happen to be part of, where hyper individualism with no even experimental practice of looking at everybody's interdependence. It's this idea that we don't need everybody else. This pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can live alone as long as you need to if you're powerful enough, you know? So it becomes easy not to express feelings and not to show our children, because I see it right here and now, right here and now in my life, because I can show my son love. I can show him how to love himself by loving myself. My theory is that, especially with children, but maybe with everybody, the best way to affect change, the best way to see what we want to see, is the golden rule. It's something I heard all the way back to my extreme childhood, like to the beginning of my existence. I remember my father telling me that for every action, if somebody did that to you, how would you feel? Always treat other people how you want to be treated. And it goes through both sides of that prism. It goes back and forth, because it is reflected and reflected back through modeling our own behavior. So, what's an example of this? You know, I feel guilty sometimes for not always being the most playful father and the most playful character for my son. And I feel bad about that when I know he wants to play with me, but I need to spend time taking care of myself as well, which is why I do things like take long baths. And I only have a little bit of time at the end of a workday, like 4 to 5 hours, but I'll still spend 1 hour of that sitting in a bath and getting calm and relaxing myself, because I'm a high energy person. When I'm not stoned, I'm rabid, like the jumping rabbit, you know, like the Energizer Bunny, like da, 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 da. And so I have to calm down when I get home, and I have to relax, and I have to get into a space where I'm not gonna accidentally hurt somebody. You know, not physically, but just with my tenseness. And I do it at work too, because I'll be going so fast and working so hard that I'll mess people up and I'll work against them because I'm not considering anything outside my bubble in that power zone. So I sit in warmth and quiet and I find myself and I have conversations in my head and I investigate what's going on. I ask questions like, what's up, guys? What are we worried about? You know, because I'll feel okay when I'm using the energy and I'm pushing towards some activity, some towards of, you know, fruition, completion, whatever you want to call it. And once I get that, it's a boost of dopamine and it's just another drug and I feel good. And then I go find another thing to do. And there's different levels of this. Sometimes it's high intensity and we're getting a lot of shit done as I'm trying to do it as fast as possible. Sometimes, you know, it's a weekend and I'm slowly tying events together because I can't stand to do little and my meditation practice has lagged. And so this ability to tie things together, activities, you know, it keeps the party going, you know, in some way. And a lot of sober people, I think, turn into these kind of people where they stop using things to feel good and then they just start using things to feel good. And like by things, I mean just other different types of things like activities. You know, they become workaholics or they run 90 miles a day. I did that too for a while. But quiet, not activity, you know, that could be sitting on a towel or that could be sitting in a bath. And my son sees this almost every day, and I tell him, I have to get home, I have to relax. And I hope in some way that will bleed on to him. That's what I mean by modeling, is that I hope one day, if he's like me, which I'm pretty sure he is, because he's already a higher energy little boy, that he will at least know that there is a reason and an ability for us to slow down and to take hold of our hearts and our breaths and to be able to find a pause and be able to break. It's a really weird thing when we can do that too. You know, I used to do ice showers, like ice baths, really cold water. Enjoyed that a lot. When you expose yourself to super cold something, I bet you would work with air too, but it has this response on your body. And I know I've explained this in the show before, but I'm going to say it again, where you have this sympathetic response and a parasympathetic response. It's like these two different directions that your nervous system can go into. And the sympathetic response is pumping dopamine, norepinephrine, getting things firing. And so we're getting ready to fight, you know, and our heart rate raises, blood, skin flushes, you know, the whole ordeal. Anxiety, like intense anxiety, is an extreme overuse of this system. And then you have the parasympathetic response, where that is the brakes. It is GABA. It is slowing down nerve firings, reducing heart rate, blood pressure, reducing the rate of breath. And this is a physiological response and ability of the body. We can put brakes on energy. But too often, I think we convince ourselves that we are in this schema where we are at the whims of our emotions, at the whims of our practicabilities, our thoughts. But I disagree with that notion. I don't think we are our thoughts. I don't think we are our emotional weather that happens to arise at certain times of the day. And it can be dynamic. There is no just bright, shiny gooiness. When I read the Buddha talking about a permanent nirvana, I don't think that is effectually attainable by many people. And I'm not sure if I'll ever see it in this lifetime. But I can practice loosely breaking myself. Not breaking, not like a breaking stick, but breaking like B-R-A-K-E, you know what I mean? Like, if I can put the brakes on and start to have some fundamental impact on my system instead of letting it run haywire, I feel that is a step towards becoming a unitarian in at least my body. And if we're considering these concepts of a universal body, doesn't it make sense that the cells have to become fully aware before everything is able to be fully aware? So I was reading this interesting book that I was talking about last week, The Tao of Physics. And in it, he's analyzing the Buddhist concept of a bodhisattva, which is an enlightened being who basically promises to stay so until all the enlightened beings go. But he puts this logical impasse on it that I found very interesting. And he's like, philosophically, how could one alone individual go into eternity if eternity is everything? Like on a Hindu Brahmanic level, if everything is part of the body, then every aspect of reality has to be awakened for the body to be awakened. You know? And so that's what I'm conceiving here, at least in the effectiveness of a personal practice, whence we are trying to ascend to the heights and, you know, have all these lofty aspects for ourselves and have these concepts of perfectness that is seeing our current body and conditions, our karma, and looking at what's going on right now and sees that as faulty and sees that as needing to be fixed, you know, seeing it as incomplete. But perhaps learning how to use what's going on right now and through mindfulness, becoming closer connected to our bodies, you know, learning how to slow down, learning how to see patterns, learn how to patternize into knowledge so that we stop adding extra fear, extra anxiety, extra pressure, all that extraness. All right. Well, that's my little, I guess, ramble. Yeah, that wasn't very clear this week for sure, but I think I hit some of the main points that I've been thinking about. Really hope so. A lot of these thoughts go back to a really good day I had last week when I was at work, and I just noticed myself going too fast, and I just had this inner dialogue. And over a 30-second period, it's like everything just decelerated, and I just was able to slow down, and the pressure didn't just get moved. Like, it was like my body listened to me, and it was such a nice feeling. And I know I've felt it in meditation before, but that's sitting in a quiet room. This wasn't a busy location. It was a busy situationship. So that was what was endearing and compelling about it. And so that's kind of what brought it to this focus, kind of. I hope I focused it. But if you'd like to email me about any of this stuff or have a conversation or ask questions if I wasn't clear, you can email me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. I want to be available for you as a friend and as a co-patriot in life. I see you all as brothers and sisters in totality, but you're all individual, beautiful little specks of perception. And the fact that all of you are seeing a slightly different skew of all of thisness just excites me. And that's why I wanted to make this, is because I want to have a line where I'm trying to help, and I want to bring some awareness to what I feel a lot of other people have been trying to bring an awareness to since the beginning of human time. And I believe that in my heart. I believe that in my soul. And I know that I am personally working towards more peace in my life. And I know it's not an overnight ordeal, but I'm building something. I'm building a place for me of peace. And over the decades of the rest of my life, I know that's only going to get stronger. And I want to help other people be able to make that for themselves, like a fort, like a blanket fort inside you, like a heart, like inside your heart. I don't know if that makes any sense. I want to help you have the softest, coziest, easiest fucking way to be with you as possible so that you can show yourself that compassion. All right, that's enough of my floozy bullshit. Like, I'm gonna go find a book, and then we'll find Odin, and then I'll let you go for the week. I think I found the perfect one. I'm excited. This is from Aldous Huxley's Island, which is a beautiful book. Maybe not the most approachable book. I would advise learning some basic concepts of spiritualism and the New Age-ish movement, which I know that's a really bad derogatory word to put on it, but there's this new bend of all these ideas that have come in the last six, like 60-ish years about, that blends a lot of these philosophical systems into this idea that Huxley perpetuates very fluently in a wonderful novel. I've been having dreams about this book, and it has had an effect on me for sure. So here goes. "What's the next item?" Will asked. "The lower fourth," Miss Narayan answered, "and they're working on elementary practical psychology." She opened a green door. "Well, now you know," Will heard a familiar voice saying. Nobody has to feel pain. You told yourselves that the pen wouldn't hurt, and it didn't hurt. They stepped into the room, and there, very tall in the midst of a score of plump or skinny little brown bodies, was Susila MacPhail. She smiled at them, pointed to a couple of chairs in a corner of the room, and turned back to the children. Nobody has to feel pain, she repeated. But never forget, pain always means that something is wrong. You've learned to shut pain off, but don't do it thoughtlessly. Don't do it without asking yourselves the question. What's the reason for this pain? And if it's bad, or if there's no obvious reason for it, tell your mother about it, or your teacher, or any grown-up in your mutual adoption club. Then shut off the pain. Shut it off, knowing that if anything needs to be done, it will be done. Do you understand? And now, she went on, after all these questions have been asked and answered, now let's play some pretending games. Shut your eyes and pretend you're looking at the poor old Mina bird with one leg that comes to school every day to be fed. Can you see him? Of course they could see him. The one-legged Mina was evidently an old friend. See him just as clearly as you saw him today at lunchtime. And don't stare at him. Don't make any effort. Just see what comes to you and let your eyes shift from its beak to his tail, from his bright little round eye to his one orange leg. I can hear him too, a little girl volunteered. He's saying, Karun, Karun. That's not true, another child said indignantly. He's saying, attention. He is saying both those things, Susila assured him, and probably a lot of other words besides. And now you're going to do some real pretending. Pretend that there are 2 one-legged minor birds, 3 one-legged minor birds, 4 one-legged minor birds. Can you see all 4 of them? They could. 4 one-legged minor birds at the 4 corners of the square and a 5th one in the middle. And now let's make them change their color. They're white now. 5 white minor birds with yellow heads and 1 orange leg. And now the heads are blue, bright blue. And the rest of the bird is pink. 5 pink birds with blue heads, and they keep changing. They're purple now. 5 purple birds with white heads, and each of them has 1 pale green leg. Goodness, what is happening? There aren't 5 of them, there are 10. No, 20, 50, 100, hundreds and hundreds. Can you see all of them? Some of them could, without the slightest difficulty. And for those who couldn't go the whole hog, Susila proposed more modest goals. Just make 12 of them, she said. Or if 12 is too many, make 10. Make 8. That's still an awful lot of minus. And now, she went on, when all the children had conjured up all the purple-white birds that each of them was capable of creating, now they're gone. She clapped her hands. Gone. Every single one of them. There's nothing there. And now you're not going to see Minas, you're going to see me. 1 me in yellow, 2 me's in green, 3 me's in blue with pink spots, 4 me's in the brightest red you ever saw. She clapped her hands again. All gone, and this time it's Mr. Narion and that funny-looking man with the stiff leg who came in with her. 4 of each of them standing in a big circle in the gymnasium, and now they're dancing the Rakshasi hornpipe. So stamp it out, stamp it out. There was a general giggle. The dancing wills and principal must have looked richly comical. Susila snapped her fingers. Away with them. Vanish. And now each of you sees 3 of your mothers and 3 of your fathers running around their playground. Faster, faster, faster. And suddenly, they're not there anymore. And then they are there. But next moment, they aren't. They are, they aren't. They are, they aren't. The giggles swelled into squeals of laughter. At the height of the laughter, a bell rang. The lesson in elementary practical psychology was over. What's the point of it all? Will asked when the children had run off to play and Miss Narion had returned to her office. The point, Susila answered, is to get people to understand that we're not completely at the mercy of our memory and our fantasies. If we're disturbed by what's going on inside our heads, we can do something about it. It's all a question of being shown what to do and when, and then practicing. The way one learns to write or play the flute. What those children you saw here were being taught is a very simple technique, a technique that we'll develop later on into a method of liberation. Not complete liberation, of course, but half a loaf is a great deal better than no bread. This technique won't lead you to the discovery, of your Buddha nature, but it will help you to prepare for that discovery. Help you by liberating you from the hauntings of your own painful memories, your remorses, your causeless anxieties about the future. All right. So that's, I guess I didn't set it up, but he's visiting a school, and what they're looking at is a bunch of fourth graders, so a bunch of children who are about 9 or 10, and they're doing these pretending exercises where the lady's telling them what to visualize in their head, and she's connecting it to self-control techniques in order to help alleviate pain. You know, before this scene in the book, Will is described to of a man who's able to have surgery without any anesthesia, just by being able to think the pain away. There's stories of, you know, who was the Cynic philosopher? I think it wasn't Diogenes, it was his teacher, or somebody right before him, like Crites, I think. But he was so dedicated to his skepticism that he had a surgery without any anesthesia whatsoever. And then the story was described as having no pain and not even flinching. You hear about it in all the different rituals in tribal societies, like in tattoos and in ceremonial uses of hardcore substances. I think it applies. I see connections. And I hope that that wraps up some of the ideas that I hope to express this morning. I'm very grateful for you giving me your time and your attention. I'm just so grateful for this opportunity. I know I say it many times throughout the show, but this is for you. And it means the world to me. I'm going to go find O.
Hello, it's Ask O. And
I need to yell.
I know, but it's the gingerbread man too. But so, how are you guys doing?
I don't know. How are you? It's about you.
Ah, that's true.
What are you doing?
I don't know, basically. I just do a lot, you know?
A lot? Like? A lot of what, TV stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
You're going to need to go do some outdoor stuff today.
I know, but that's true. I heard about it's going to be beautiful outside, so you guys should go outside too.
That's wonderful advice.
Yeah.
I like it. I dig it. Anything else cool happening?
Lemon.
Any advice on how to live a good life?
Okay. No.
Cool. All right. Bye.
I'm hungry.